Okay, let's do some review. We spent our time finishing up the fourth parable, chapter 9, last time. Basically, the theme has been that he was overwhelmed, and what we saw then in the last chapter was his attempt to gain control. We went pretty quickly because there wasn't all that much really interesting in that. One of the ways he tried to gain control of the experience is to say, well, this is really an experience of the Holy Spirit. So that he tried to fit it into what he knew. Other images that came up very strongly was was this theme of separation. He's trying to get a distance from the experience, that he's trying to turn the experience into something light. So he equates it to the light of the Holy Spirit. The other theme was that he still talked in what I would call Trinitarian language, which is power language, where what he thinks is going on is that the Holy Spirit operates on matter. And we talked about the difference between operating on matter and operating with matter. That was basically it. And now we start a new chapter. We went pretty quickly in the last chapter, but we're really going to get bogged down again because there's so much material in this. And I'll just mention it now. I'll mention it again before we actually get to it. What we'll be seeing now is we saw the mess. We saw the mess in the major images, remember, have been the darkness, the flood, and the prison. Darkness and the flood, being overwhelmed by experience. The prison, Sophia being in prison, was the inaccessible nature of the meaning of the experience to him. And we had this chapter on the attempts to control the experience, which is what we just did. And what we're going to see now, and I think it's one of the real valuable and interesting parts of this work, is how the psyche begins to try to heal this experience. So we'll be looking at various images of healing. Now, the idea is that when you get all mucked up, you enter into a process. It's like jumping in a stream. It's an archetype in Jung's language of transformation. And that archetype has certain typical steps, certain particular times, certain typical images. This is what Jung, you know, discovered in his Night Sea Journey from 1913 to 1928, which he termed the self. We're seeing its operation here in the framework of Sophia, difference being Sophia is this experience of symbols in matter. So we will begin to watch how the psyche begins generating the images that would represent how you solve this problem. Since he doesn't really understand this, that healing doesn't take place, but the images continue to be generated. It's almost to our advantage that he doesn't understand it, because the psyche keeps trying to drive home again and again these images of healing. Just because he doesn't get them doesn't mean they don't stop being generated. The transformation that they're looking for doesn't occur, but their presence is still really helpful for us to understand. How does it look when you have been messed up? What images start to appear to put you back together again? And how do you recognize those? We'll look at several specific ones, and then we'll look at a general pattern, which I'll just mention now, and I'll come back to it several times, of the communio, the image of union. Now, that image of union doesn't sort of dance on stage and say, here I am. It comes in little hints. And that's what she'll be doing, is showing us the hints in this image, in these images, that suggest that there is this process of synthesis, of unification going on in the psyche. Some of you who did, I think, Mysterium, we talked about the three stages of the conjunctio, and that's what she's going to look at in here. I'll explain all that. But it's basically a three-step process, and we'll get the first hints of that step in this chapter, and then subsequently it will unfold. So you're going to have to kind of have a stereo mind to understand from now on. There will be our specific images, which we'll understand, and then we'll be seeing a superstructure over them, which is the larger pattern of union that all of these specific images represent. So we'll be doing two things, looking at images, and I'll keep saying, now, keep this big pattern in mind, and then we'll come back to the details, and I'll say, here's where we are in the big pattern, and we'll go along, okay, here's where we are in the big pattern, so we'll be shuttling back and forth between the two. Questions on that? All sounds clear. Last time, I don't think it was all that hard. It's going to get hard again. Our vacation's over. Yeah, it's hard. Yeah, it was hard for me. And really, it's tough going. Two details that I thought I would follow up on that were raised last time, two questions. One was, why is salt described as eros? I never really answered that question. The other question was, how does Jung, and where does Jung talk about the psyche? They were two leftovers. So I just want to spend a few minutes mopping up from last time. I thought I'd read you a passage from Edinger's Mysterium Lectures where he talks about Jung talking about salt. When in doubt, if you are interested in Mysterium, you know, be sure to get this book, Mysterium Lectures, because it's a study guide to Mysterium, which is probably at least as hard or more harder than this book. It's just got so much information. So I always go to this first, and he kind of lays it out linearly and can kind of help make sense out of it. But let me just read you his citing Jung in Mysterium talking about salt and eros. This is in paragraph 330 in Mysterium, and it's on page 166 in this book. If you want, I can read you more. Depends on how much you want to know. Here's what Jung says. I'll skip a little bit. Bitterness and wisdom form a pair of opposites with a third thing between. That's the first big sentence. Bitterness and wisdom form a pair of opposites with a third thing in between. The factor common to both, however incommensurable the two ideas may seem, is psychologically the function of feeling. Tears, sorrow, and disappointment are bitter. But wisdom is the comforter in all psychic suffering. Indeed, bitterness and wisdom form a pair of alternatives. Where there is bitterness, wisdom is lacking. And where wisdom is, there can be no bitterness. Salt, as the carrier of this fateful alternative, is coordinated with the nature of woman. So, the link between bitterness and wisdom is feeling. It is the adjustment in values which makes that shift possible. And salt is linked up with wisdom. And since wisdom is the evolution of feeling, they then link up salt with that feeling, or eros. Now, I can say more, or we can leave it there. Which do you want to do? More? Just because it doesn't get any easier. I just want to make sure you don't. I feel you don't want to get too confused. But so he, Edinger then goes to the essay, The Psychology of the Transference. Some of us have worked on this in several different contexts. In the Collected Works, paragraph, volume 16, paragraph 361. I'm going to meander a little bit until I get to the point. So the first bit is going to be introductory. Four stages of eroticism. That's the key, eroticism. Were known in the late classical period. Eve, Helen of Troy, the Virgin Mary, and Sophia. Maybe we just stop there for a second and look at that sentence, because that's pretty loaded. You know, I quite frankly admit I'm somewhere between stage two and three. Put it very crudely, what does it mean that Eve, Helen, Virgin Mary, and Sophia are all stages of Eros? Well, putting it in my somewhat basic framework, for a guy at least, the first thing that a young man finds sexy about a woman is her physical appearance. That's Eve. Helen is likewise attractive because she's physically attractive, but she brings with it cultural achievement. So, in other words, as a man's Eros develops, and I think it's the same for women, but with different figures, it's actually a woman's cultural self that becomes sexy. It's a different kind of sexual attraction, but that is what draws a man to a woman, her cultural mind. So that's why he calls it Eros. It is so because it is an evolution of the biological physical attractiveness. And it is still an attractiveness. And it is still what leads to sexual desirousness, but it's not purely physical anymore. It's cultural. But what we need to understand is how he sees culture as another form of Eros. Real culture, not culture vulture junk, but like, I think that for a woman, maybe the epitome there would have been Arthur Miller. I don't know. I mean, I'm straight as can be, but I thought that guy was sexy because of his generation of culture. It just, he had a magnetism that drew you to him.
So did Marilyn.
Sorry?
So did Marilyn.
Well, yeah. She almost did him in.
She and who was it? They had their list of men that they wanted to bed before they died. Einstein was one of them.
She had Einstein on her list?
Yeah.
I'm sure he would have cooperated.
Oh, yeah. They spent some time alone.
So. Oh. Well, good for him.
Yeah.
he definitely liked the ladies.
Yeah, did he?
Oh, yeah.
And Marilyn Monroe, and who? There were several. I'm trying to think of the other actress that she corroborated with. I'll see if I can find it.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. The men she chooses.
He's not a physically attractive man.
Right.
But there is something so magnetically lovable about him. Because he writes these powerful pieces which are so relevant, because he stood up to, and he died recently, so this is on the mm-hmm. paper. He stood up, he was arrested for contempt of Congress. That's mm-hmm. not small potatoes. He said, the Congress, go to hell. I'm not testifying. Throw me in prison. I don't care. See, that's this quality, and that is a dimension of Eros. This is what Jung is wanting us to say, which evolves out of sexuality. There's a continuum. And why that's important here? Because you see, Sophia begins with a sexual experience. So the next thing would be the Virgin Mary. That spiritual devotion becomes the trigger for Eros. And then finally, wisdom. So you see, there's a gradation between Eve and Sophia, and they are all different forms of love, different levels of love. Now you see how we're getting back to salt, but we still have a detour to take.
So what is that step from virgin to Sophia?
Wisdom.
So what? How would you say it for wisdom? Like for virgin, you said spirituality becomes the trigger for Eros, and in Helen it was culture becomes the trigger for Eros. So
in Sophia, it'd be wisdom.
Wisdom itself.
Yeah. I'm trying to skip here a little bit. What's the first stage, Eve, is purely biological. Woman is equated with the mother and only represents something to be fertilized. The second stage is still dominated by the sexual eros, that's what I was saying. But on an aesthetic and romantic level, where the woman already has acquired some value as an individual. Also what I was saying. The third stage raises Eros to the heights of religious devotion and thus spiritualizes him. Eve has been replaced by spiritual motherhood. So that would be the creative and the devotion to individuation, I think you might say in our language.
So which stage was that?
The third, Virgin Mary.
Devotion to what?
Individuation.
But not equivalent.
No, she would represent the ability to devote yourself to your process. Okay. You know, there's something higher than the ego. Finally, the fourth stage illuminates something which unexpectedly goes beyond the almost unsurpassable third stage, wisdom. How can wisdom transcend the most holy and the most pure? In other words, how can it transcend the virgin? Presumably only by virtue of the truth that the less sometimes means the more. This stage represents the spiritualization of Helen and consequently of Eros as such. So because wisdom is that endpoint of the transformation of Eros, and because salt represents wisdom, salt then is linked up with Eros. That was the point of my going on.
So sexuality is linked up to wisdom.
Exactly. There is this continuum between instinct and spirit. And real wisdom comes through having lived sexually, having lived culturally, having lived spiritually. And just becoming wise without that journey is meaningless. That's not real wisdom.
So you have to have experienced physical fire and spiritual fire, and then...
Because one fire sets the stage for the emergence of the other. Which is why, you know, going back to Arthur Miller, I often thought he had to have that relationship with Marilyn Monroe. The erotic fire that he must have felt for her eventually got put into cultural fire, into his work. And he had to be crucified by that experience to get there. Which is one other reason why I respect him so much. He didn't say, she's sick, I'm not going to do this. He said, that's where my fire is, I'm going there. And he said he spent every day dealing with her problems when they were married. Yeah. But that fire that's in his plays was first a physical fire for her, I would think. And that's the gradation. So that's the link between Eros wisdom and salt. Does that help you at all? It's kind of convoluted, but you can see there is a logic in there, and there is a symbolic logic. And it's pretty related to what we were talking about, because we're talking about wisdom here. And we've seen how this Sophia experience is something that starts with an instinct. And with Jung, as always, the lower is the first appearance of the higher. So Sophia would be the higher. The first appearance is the instinct.
Gary, you know, with the chance that St. Thomas wrote this, I think he would have had spiritual devotion without having the physical. So it doesn't necessarily come in as order, right?
But see, the problem is, I wouldn't say he was an integrated personality. that he did get spiritual wisdom, but without instinct. And then you see what happens in the face of life when that's your orientation. Life just blows you apart. And, you know, again, it's easy to criticize him from a distance, but I think the other side of the, I would call the false spirituality, going to the virgin or the wisdom stage without having gone through the lower fire, is you cannot assess the demands of the time. Somehow, going through that is what keeps you in touch with the historical moment. And again, my hero Miller, why his plays were so utterly historically relevant.
So Thomas was never really an animal on this earth. He didn't have that animal experience.
Right. Which, and if you don't have the full animal experience, your spiritual destination will be thinner.
Weren't Miller's plays, though, becoming the most well-known, written before the Maryland experience?
I'm thinking my favorite, which is, I think the one he wrote before his death, which is not very well-known, called The Glass House. Okay. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't seen that one.
Well, After the Fall was about Marilyn Monroe, though. She was
After
the character
the
in it.
Was, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Was that before Marilyn?
Yeah,
that
was.
Both
of those
were before. I know
she
has two.
Mm-hmm. And when was The Crucible? Is that after? That was after, wasn't it?
No, I think that was before.
Was that before?
I'm not positive about that. But I was just wondering about that.
Well, I think it was his appetite for life.
Which
came out in him following. If you ever have a chance, you want to see, I think it's probably available in the video stores. It's psychologically brilliant. And I guess he was, just a quick note, I guess he was very interested in Jung. There was a guy in L.A. I heard lecture, and they were apparently friends, a Jungian in L.A. So he must have either done some Jungian work or had read a lot of Jung, I think.
What's that one called, The Glass?
It's called The Glass House, I think, or The Glass Night. It's a play on Kristallnacht, the Night of Glass.
Oh.
And it's just a brilliant psychological study. Now, remember, Miller was Jewish, so he could get away with this. It's a play about an American family in New York while Kristallnacht is going on in Germany. Remember Kristallnacht when the Nazis that's when they really started the pogrom against the Jews and broke the shop windows. That's why it was called Night of Glass. Well, in the play, the wife is just livid about the damage that's being done in Europe to the Jews. And as the play goes on, you watch her slowly destroying her own family. With the same repressiveness, she's blaming the Nazis having on the Jews. So he brings that home, how we project our evil. And yes, there's a historical issue, but if you only are aware of historical repression and you don't ignore your own personal version of it, you're just as destructive as the people you are blaming. I just thought it was brilliant. And you watch her, she is Hitler, complaining about the way the Nazis are destroying the Jews. And by the end of the, because it's a tragedy, by the end of the play, I won't ruin it for you, but you can imagine. So that kind of insight, I think has to have come through living fire. To be that sensitive and have the courage to express that about his own people. But it really isn't about Jews, of course, it's about our own projection of evil. Okay, that's the Erosmus song. Really important because, you know, how much of the time are we working with love problems in therapy? And they are often, if you can understand them, stages in the evolution of the person's eros. The other thing that Carol asked me about was psyche. And I'll just give you Jung's very quick definition of psyche. If you don't have this book and you're looking for some place to spend money, it's a very good little textbook on Jungian terms. It's very boring, but it's very complete. It's Yolanda Jacoby, The Psychology of C.G. Jung.
There's a lot of the terms, though, Bob and I have been finding in that typology book, psychological types.
Yes, the back of psychological types.
That's some good stuff in there, too.
Very good. The psyche consists of two complementary but antithetical spheres, consciousness and the unconscious. Our ego has a share in both. That's his definition of psyche. This is page 5. It's the first thing she talks about.
Who's the author?
Yolanda Jacoby, J-O-C. J-A-C-O-B-I. So the idea is there, as I tried to put it, it's our psychologicalness. And we say psyche as opposed to material. And so things like spirit, soul, they're all subcategories of psyche. Does that make sense if I put it that way? The spirit is that forward-creating stuff. The soul of the soul would be the feminine side. But it's a term that we use a lot and we don't really take time to define, so I thought I'd just take a minute with that.
For some reason, I just recently was looking up psyche myself on something, and they were talking about her having butterfly wings. I just wondered, you know, as far as the legends kind of things, why would she be personified with butterfly wings?
Well, first of all, psyche in Greek means butterfly.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
And then how does that transfer to psyche in us?
Because that means that we are... That psychology is butterflyology. That's what it means. Well...
That have anything to do with like the cocoon and the or the butter or the caterpillar cocoon?
I think one that it's it goes through a transformative process.
Mm. Okay.
I think the other that it's at home in the wind, and so the psyche is like that resonator which we. It's so delicate because it feels the currents of the spirit.
Mm.
I remember my first dream in therapy, my first dream when I was in Zurich, was that a butterfly landed on my hand.
Ooh.
It was a beautiful monarch. And I looked at it and I said, now I can catch this butterfly and take control of it. Or I can let it fly away and see where it wants to go. I decided to let it fly away and see where it wanted to go. So it's the psyche's natural method of symbolizing the psyche. And that the psyche has its own intentionality.
There was a... I'd like to share... there's a poem that... I don't remember a lot of things in my life, but this one I do... Love is like a butterfly. The more you chase it, it's not a poem, it's actually just verse. The more you chase it and chase it directly, the more it eludes you. But if you sit quietly and turn your mind to other things, it comes and softly sits mm-hmm. on your shoulder.
Mm-hmm. That's the way you relate to the psyche. You can't grab it. Yeah, that's what we've been talking about here, how this experience is an autonomous experience. And what Thomas has tried to do is grab it, rather than hear its message and let it lead. Okay, questions?
So the one we analyze our dreams and so forth, then is that what we're doing? Hear the message and then
seeing where the butterfly wants to go.
Yeah, okay.
And it's that delicate. Mm-hmm. And if you think of the zigzag movement of the butterfly, mm-hmm. that's very typical for the psyche. It doesn't get you there in a straight line. It throws you all over the place. Because it knows if it follows the linear path, it is vulnerable to predators. Predators would be our rational consciousness. Okay, 314. I warn you, we're going to go slow. I start at the top of 314. The fifth parable takes an important step beyond the liberating, purifying, and distilling procedures described in the first four parables. For it treats of the treasure house which wisdom built upon a rock. What this means, anticipating, is we're going to be looking at the image of the house. And the image of the house would represent the psyche creating a space, or creating an attitude in you or in us, where we can meet an understanding of wisdom. See how this differs from what we've seen before. We've had overflowing, we've had imprisonment, we've had control, and now the psyche is trying to generate an image of meeting, a meeting place. As we'll see, what is met in that house is the self. We'll be looking at self-images. Again, anticipating what the self represents in contrast to what's gone before is stability. The anima, for the man, or if it had been a woman, the animus, is chaotic. That's been our theme up to now, the chaos of this experience. But now we start getting images of stability, not images of repression like we had before, but images of meeting and stability. So you see how the psyche begins to try to integrate the very experience that it first overpowered you with. Wisdom hath built herself a house, which if any man enter in, he shall be saved and find pastures. As the prophet beareth witness, they shall be inebriated with the plenty of thy house. For better is one day in thy courts above thousands. Now, this gets a little confusing, and I will try to simplify it a little bit, because I don't think we need every last detail here. But I'll be happy if I can communicate the general idea. And I'll read you the next paragraph. The alchemical basis for this parable is to be found, first of all, in Senior. Senior is that Arabic alchemist, who compares the lapis to a house with four walls. Now, the key image there that we'll be looking at is this four. And then more particularly in Alphidius, blah, blah, blah. I will show thee the place of this stone. Know, my son, that this knowledge is in a certain place, and that this place is everywhere. The place is the four elements, and they are four doors, etc. So you get four again. So what we're beginning to do is beginning to investigate the symbolism of the self. And one of the key themes about self-symbolism is based on four. Why? Well, she has two reasons. One is not so hard, and that is that not total knowledge has to do with all four functions. So knowledge of your totality involves knowing yourself through all four functions, thinking, feeling, sensation, intuition.
Okay, and we're covering that in Dream Analysis Seminar, too. Now, we've got the self is...
Oh, I forget, too.
Oh, I just was setting up, but I wanted to know what was east and west, because I looked through all that whole doggone book and looked in the index and couldn't figure out...
I don't think I would try to say...
not even in your, not for analyzing your dreams, though?
Well, your own associations would be at least, if not more important, for figuring out what is what. I think I've heard north associated with intuition. But, you know, take this with a grain of salt. I would hate to try to pin it down. Or thinking sometimes, too, because if you think, well...
The north and south were the thinking and feeling.
Were they? Okay.
I think.
I guess the first intuitive thing...
And I don't remember which one was which.
The feeling would be the south because it's warmer. And so the opposite would be thinking, which is north, which is
colder. See, what they keep talking, though, about is that you've got your primary ones of both of those, and then also
auxiliary.
That fourth one is the inferior one.
Mm-hmm.
That are you trying to integrate? Are you trying to get the fourth one?
Mm-hmm.
That's okay.
Although you'll never be completely successful because it's always unruly. You can kind of get it. Well, the main function would be the main function, and what Jung calls the least developed would be the opposite of that, of your main, and that he calls that the inferior, okay. Inferior function. And the two other ones are what he calls auxiliary functions, and the idea is that, you know, thinking and feeling are opposites. Sensation and intuition are opposites. And the basic idea is you're generally good at one thing. You can think well, you can feel well, you have good hunches, or you're good with things. And so you've got one main function. And the opposite, then, is something that's always going to be a stumbling block for you. You also have two auxiliary functions, which may or may not be developed, but in the course of a lifetime, you can develop those. The last one is always a stumbling block.
Now, if you're dealing with somebody who is basically a feeling person, mm-hmm. do you treat them as a feeling person, or mm-hmm. do you appeal mm-hmm. to the thinking?
I would, depending on how mature they are, you'd start with the main function.
Which would, be, in that case, be the feeling?
If they were a feeling type, yeah.
And if they were the thinking type, you would start with the thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, I swear there's things in both of these books that contradict that.
Well, that may very well be. A lot of it depends on what stage you are. Because if you're a well-adapted person who's bored with life, you want to try to talk to the person where they're not developed.
Yeah, and especially if you're studying this stuff and you're being bombarded with the information, you have more information than maybe the normal person who would have, so you would want, but is that more of a thinking thing? Because you would want more of the information.
Thinking and sensation, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Now, see, I used to be interested in information, and that got knocked out of me. You realize, what good is it? It's just information. But I was identified with my thinking function, and I had to disidentify from it, which is why I don't get upset when there's contradictions.
Mm.
I used to get upset when there were contradictions. Now, I think human beings are predictable. Why should thoughts be predictable? And I'm much happier. The other thing, which is really more interesting and really to our point, is that the self is integrated in four steps. And I have brought in the larger model from Ion, that this is a little schema of. Yeah, I think they got it. Mm-hmm. This isn't going to make a lot of sense, but it will give you a rough idea. As far as Jung, now I'm putting a little parenthesis, I'll explain this and then I'll come back to the book. Jung's idea is that the self develops in four stages. See, we're back to four again. Now, he variously describes what those stages are, but the basic idea is from a low form to a high form. In this chart, the beginning of this development of the self would be at the very bottom, and it would be chaos, which splits up into different material elements so that the four aspects of the self at this level of self-development are from the physical world. And they eventually, if you succeed in integrating the self at this level, would be represented by the stone, by an inanimate object. That's the lapis. And what's that mean in ordinary speech? It means that depending on where your hang-up is, you're going to get imagery of yourself in that area where you need to develop. Because most of us are not living on the earth. We don't know our feelings. We don't have confidence in our person. Very often, that's where the self symbolism starts. It's about down-to-earth things. It's about how you talk to your spouse, how you talk to the grocer, how you deal with the police. It's about these time, concrete time and space. Issues of self-esteem, power, and so on. Now, if you choose to stay with the process, you will find within the stability that you've accrued, another conflict starts. And the self is pressing for integration at a higher level. So the imagery that will appear in your dreams at that point are images of nature. For rivers, for chipmunks, for rabbits. That would represent your identity at a different level than the previous. So what Jung simply did, he just asked himself, why do some people dream of four chipmunks, and some people of four stones, some people of four angels, some people of four human beings? Well, because they are all the self at different stages. So the symbolism of the first stage is mineral, the symbolism of the second stage is plant, the symbolism of the second stage, the third stage is animal and human. Symbolism of the fourth stage is spiritual, four gods or something like that, four angels. She brings that up just to give amplification to the fourness reference in the house. And to say, and then in the picture you see they're linked. So really this should be a circle. This then goes back down here. So if you stay with your development, you will integrate yourself from low to high, and you'll start all over again. Low to high. So it's a spiral.
Then there's more mineral symbolism?
Then there would be more mineral symbolism. Then that would transform into plant symbolism, animal and human, and so on. I didn't put it in a circle because I thought it made it easier to understand if you saw it in a linear fashion. But it's actually a circle.
So that makes it a spiral.
That makes it a spiral.
And so then, so how many... So is it like an infinite number of spirals?
Infinite. It's very helpful when you're dealing with self-images. You know, you've got some of your dreams of four rocks. Or four... They're four brothers or something like that. To know that you're working with the self at a different level and what that level is. She calls that, there on page 315, certain dynamic processes of transformation within the self. It's right before the diagram, 1, 2, 3, 4 lines up. Now, why is this important? Because in Aurora, we started low, and we're trying to go high.
What was that you just mentioned?
Oh, I'm just saying it.
The page.
Oh, what the diagram is?
Oh, you were talking about the diagram.
Yeah, I was just saying why I mentioned this, why I'm making so much of this, and why she mentions it, I think, is because in Aurora, the transformation starts from low to high. And here is the basic principle of Jungian psychology, I believe, that's what real transformation is about, low to high. As we've seen in Aurora, the problem today is that we are too high. Too intellectual, too spiritual, with a huge shadow.
So, as I recall, you could have an image in your dream of, you know, flying or something.
Mm-hmm.
So that might show that you're at that point and ready to go.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Exactly. And that the spiritual task of our time is to transform from low to high. And that's what the Sophia experience is trying to introduce. Not a spirituality that is high, but a spirituality that starts low.
Well, would you say starting low would be disbelief?
Despair.
Despair. Okay.
Sexuality.
Okay.
Aggression. Hatred.
Okay.
Failure.
Okay.
In terms of our Sophia language, these experiences are meant to be the beginning of your spiritual development. They're not in place of success. They are the beginning of a genuine road to genuine wholeness. And that's part of the meaning of this whole Aurora text. There is such a thing as religious experience, but it starts low. And for 2,000 years, it started high.
Then you're supposed to start with the feeling.
Start with what you've stubbed your toe on. For a lot of us, it's feeling. Certainly was for me.
But if somebody normally is a feeling person, then they have to start with thinking.
Mm-hmm. Or sensei. Mm-hmm. Mm. You know, I've just been listening to some of Marion's tapes, and she says, I individuated because of my eating disorder. That's another example. Not in spite of, but because of. That's this low to high business. I think that's all you really need to remember. You don't have to remember all these different stages for all purposes, but to realize how the self is a sick spiral process with a low to high to low to high to low to high rhythm. And that is the spiritual task of our time. Now, she gives on page 316 another series of four. I mean, don't get too hung up on what each of those four stages are. Just think low to high. Maybe I should mention, maybe you know this, maybe you don't, so bear with me, but I always tell people the story of the 10 stones. Have I mentioned that to you? Jung refers to that in Undiscovered Self. That it's a very simple, but I think a very helpful metaphor for how do you read this stuff, particularly like Sandy said, it seems contradictory at times, or it seems multi-layered. One place the four is described this way, another place the four is described this way, and so on. Jung uses that simple analogy of going to a parking lot, picking up 10 stones, weighing them, and they weigh 100 grams. And you say the average stone is 10 grams. You weigh each stone, and no stone is 10 grams. That's how you have to approach the psyche. What we read about is the average, and nobody fits that average. But it's a norm. We don't use it to define ourselves, but to give ourselves a point of reference. That's how I don't get upset when there are contradictory explanations, because sometimes it's like this, and sometimes it's like this.
That's why it's called individuation.
Right, exactly. Our rational mind wants a pattern. Well, there is kind of a pattern. There is kind of an average, but everybody's an exception to it. Let's do one more thing, and then we'll take a break. Go to 316, the bottom paragraph. Now, here again, the reason I said that is because the four are different, but she is discussing the text we've been doing in terms of the four stages in the transformation of the self, or in terms of the four doors that we've seen. Remember, we always have to kind of remember why we're talking about this stuff. As applied to our text, the descent of the Anthropos corresponds to wisdom's descent to the alchemist. Then follows the phase of imprisonment in physis through the influence of the shadow. So see, that's the first and second stage. which in Aurora is represented by the fall into the pit of hell. It's a fourth stage. The imprisonment is the first stage. Hell is the second stage. And all of these are elements of the descent. Phase C, the serpent, is symbolized in Aurora by the woman who brought in death. Remember that, page 2 of Mark 247, if you want to go back and remind yourself. She had arrows, and she shot with these blood arrows. The fourth phase begins in the present chapter, the crystallization process, symbolized by the building of the treasure house, which represents the coagulation of the lapis. So different levels of this experience. Each phase occupies a typical period of time. And if you cooperate with that, then you grow through it. And it has its own rhythm, its own logic. The ego is sort of a participant in the process which is given. And very simply, this material is good for understanding house dreams. I'll give you an example. See, wonder what you'd make of it. The guy in a painfully alienated state in his marriage dreams that he and his wife are traveling, and they go spend an evening in a hotel room. And their children are with them, and the children are put in an adjacent room where they will be safe. Now, I see in that dream a direct relation to this imagery. Do you see my reasoning?
They aren't safe in the same room with him and his wife.
Well, that was more so that the wife and husband could talk.
Oh, okay.
But the idea is the children were taken care of. The whole family is on this trip.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the dream, it's not a house, it's a hotel room. See how the archetype is the structural sequence, and the images vary. But if we apply what we know about the house here to that dream, what's that telling them?
Talking about the foundation.
Mm-hmm. Keep going. What did the house represent here?
Foundation of their marriage?
Well, I'm just trying to get you to build a link between the text and that dream.
Oh.
What did the house represent here?
No.
More.
A place where it was a safe temenos, a sacred space for the house, for the self to manifest.
Right, and so for them to meet self. In the visions, the house represents the ability of the psyche, or the psyche's presenting an ability for Thomas to meet the self, to meet the truth of himself. Okay? Now apply that to the motel room.
So the psyche is providing them a place to meet, and the children, who may or may not, in my mind, may or may not interfere with their ability.
They won't interfere.
Are safe.
Yeah.
They don't need to concern themselves about them.
Yeah, what the dream said to me is that the psyche is showing there will be a possibility to meet the truth about this marriage, and that both people are willing to do it, and that it includes the children. And it will benefit the children, although it doesn't immediately involve the children. Why a motel room? Right. This is a phase. So the dream, if you know this symbolism, you see, it allows you to make a very optimistic interpretation to see that that motel room as a different variation of the house is the place where you meet truth. And the two of them will go on the journey to meet the truth about their marriage. And I think, as Eileen said, it's temporary. This marriage conflict is not going to last forever. So we often don't get to see the practical use of these images because they're kind of bizarre sometimes. But there's an example where I was helped by this book in understanding a dream. Oh, that's the house. That's the house where you meet the self. And I said that. I said, don't give up hope. Dream was an encouragement. You're going to work on it. You both will work on this. Don't be afraid of discussing. Don't be afraid of fighting, because it's going to work out.
Gary, how do you know when the image in the dream is a part of your own psyche or it actually is the other person being represented?
If I dream
with my husband Jim in my dream, how do I know that that's my Jim psyche versus it's really him? Because my first thought was that he was going to have some sort of internal nuncio. And in that process, he didn't need to worry about those sides of him that were too fragile to be involved at this point. I mean, I went into that, all of those parts being him.
In the motel
dream.
Right. Well.
And I was thinking it was transitory, and then he was going to take that internal nuncio back into. That was where I was going with it, not that I was seeing his wife as actually who she was.
Yeah. I wish I could give you an answer. It's feeling. I think if I had said, which that dream could have meant that, the guy would have just looked at me like, huh? But that one clicked. Now, it could be that what is lived out in the projection of that marriage will eventually come home to him. Another, give you an example where it is just not obvious what to do, but one feels it. A guy dreamt of people landing. And it was a contest. And they were like, what do you call those? You fly with a
hang gliding.
Hang gliding. They were hang gliding down. It was a contest. They were landing. And there was a judge there saying, you came first, but you didn't win. You didn't win. You didn't win. And finally, somebody landed, and the guy in the dream said, you win. And the dreamer thought, how in the hell do you determine who the real winner is? This was in the dream. And purely speaking, I think you would need to say they are inner thoughts coming. But I looked at the guy's life, and there was just no meat for that in their life, in his life. But he told me that week, it's another marriage situation, that his wife had just blown up at him out of the blue in a very uncharacteristic way. You don't love me, and just railed on him. And on that basis, he was ready to say, yeah, I'm really sick of her. And I took those descending figures as the thoughts between the two of them. And when his wife blew up at him, that was one of those thoughts landing. But it wasn't the real thing. But communication has been opened. And he's got to wait for a couple more blow-ups until the right thought comes down. That's a coagulatio image, where a potential thing becomes real. They are trying to get at the truth, and it's going to come. It's coming in these false emotional outbursts as sort of beginning to attempt to communicate, and then there will be a genuine emotional outburst if he can wait and be able to discern. The problem isn't, you know, she doesn't talk, well, I love her. That's just bullshit, what she's saying. So I'm not going to react. And there'll be another one. And I said, you'll just have to be able to distinguish. Don't react, because this isn't the right hang glider. But there will be a hang glider at some point, which is real. And you got to know that. And you got to say, okay, now let's talk about it. Up to that point, you have to keep your mouth shut when she blows up. Now, technically speaking, that I should have said that that was something in him. I think in the long run it will be, but see, it's playing itself out in reality. So you've got to be able to know when the inner thing is played out in reality and when an interpretation on the inside is just academic. Where is the person really suffering? That's what I ask myself. That's what the dream is talking about. Later we may begin to realize that what that wife says to him is something that an inner voice is saying. So that's why it's an internal thing, really. But at the moment it's being played out outside. But it's a tough question. And I one is never sure one's right. One tries it, and then you see what comes next. If the next dream is an evolution of that, fine. If it's not, then I'll say I was wrong. Let's look at it again. Okay, let's have a stretch.